southeast. Yes, it's a chilly start today at 4, 5 or 6 degrees, but a good deal of sunshine. Also, that breeze to contend with in the morning, that will just accentuate the colder feel. But all in all, it's going to turn into a nice day with good spells of sunshine, a bit of patchy cloud here and there, dry virtually everywhere, and temperatures again a bit down in recent days, but peaking at around about 13 or 14 in the London area.
Jay Wynn, thank you. Now on Radio 4, our new book of the week, Colin McFarlane reads from Thomas Brothers' new account of one of jazz's greatest cornet players in Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism.
October 1931, Memphis, Tennessee. Louis Armstrong and his orchestra are performing at the Peabody Hotel, giving local jazz fans a chance to finally see and hear him in person. Few performers, black or white, are more exciting or innovative. Armstrong has been packing them in on this tour of the South, in city after city, in segregated white hall after segregated black hall, and with an occasional thrill of mixed patronage now and then, carefully guarded by police. On this night, everyone in the audience is white, the 10 musicians black. Armstrong announces he would like to dedicate the next song to the Memphis Police Department. Turning to the band, he sets the tempo, and they're off.
I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. Boy, I brought you into my home. You wouldn't leave my wife alone. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you.
Trombonist Preston Jackson reacts nervously. He's dedicating this song to the Memphis police? Not a bunch known for their sense of humor, and many are members of the Ku Klux Klan. What saves the moment is that while the band knows the words, the audience cannot easily make them out. For part of Armstrong's song style is a weird way of mixing words and nonsense syllables, sometimes blurring the line between the two, just as the melody he sings is part original tune and part free invention. The policemen come up afterwards to thank Armstrong. No other band coming through town has ever honored them like this, they tell him. The relationship of his band to the police was already loaded with tension. For the night before the Peabody Hotel gig, they'd all been thrown in jail. Their crime: Armstrong was discovered sitting next to his white manager's white wife on the chartered bus, the two of them talking over business. "Why didn't you shoot him in the leg?" one officer demanded from his colleague when he heard about this provocative scene. Now, they're his biggest fans. Artistically, Armstrong is at the top of his game. Yet he's crippled by a society that seethes with racism. Emancipation from slavery at the end of the Civil War was followed by a century and more of subjugation of people of African descent. They use music to strengthen their identity, and it's the thriving center of their legacy. As Louis Armstrong came of age, the African-American musical vernacular was bursting out of the plantations, spreading through the Deep South and then eventually to the urban North, laying the groundwork for the spectacular success of ragtime, blues, jazz, and gospel music. It's obvious today that cultural practice has no basis in biology. But, given the strong associations between race and culture in the 1920s, Armstrong's musical practice cannot be separated from the story of race. August 8, 1922. Nearly 10 years before the Peabody Hotel concert, 21-year-old Armstrong is riding on a train bound for Chicago, leaving his hometown of New Orleans. He sits next to a lady with three children. The lady recognizes him, says she knows his mother. This is comforting, not least because she's packed a large basket of fried chicken, enough to last all the way to California, in his estimation. Trains in the South don't include dining facilities for Negroes. They have to bring their own food. Louis is wearing most of his clothes to save on baggage, despite the heat of August. And he's lugging a small suitcase in one hand, an old case for his cornet in the other. He and his traveling companions are following a well-worn path. They're part of what will later be called The Great Migration, the Northwoods movement of African Americans from the countryside and cities of the South. Lynchings are on the rise, and the force of vigilante terrorists seems inexorable. And there's the lure of money. With jobs paying much more in the North than anything available to them anywhere in the South. The thousands of New Orleanians who go North consider only one destination seriously. By 1922, so much is known about Chicago and so little about the alternatives that there's no need for deliberation. The immigrants there find work in the meatpacking industry, in steel yards, and as porters, janitors, and domestics. During the first wave of the Great Migration, some 50,000 African Americans relocated to the Windy City. On the day of his departure, Armstrong has accepted a funeral job in New Orleans at the last minute, but it caused him to miss the train. When he finally arrives, he's worried his mentor in Chicago, band manager and trumpet sensation Joe Oliver, may not be there to meet him since he's late. As he disembarks at 12th Street Station, he looks around for some help. Finally, a red-capped porter offers assistance. "Oh, you're the young man who's to join King Oliver's band at Lincoln Gardens," he says. "Huh?" Louis has never heard his mentor called King before. The red cap flags a cab and directs him to the club, where the evening show is already in progress. The young man has never seen a city like this, with its tall buildings, bright lights, and paved streets. The cab heads down South State Street in the so-called Black Belt of Chicago. And suddenly, a few blocks up, there it is, Lincoln Gardens, already well on its way to becoming one of the most famous venues in jazz history. Flyers for Lincoln Gardens proclaimed, "Dance to the music of Joe Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, just back from a great year on the coast." Soaring popularity demanded expansion. Oliver had written to Little Louie, as he called him, the only student he ever took, to come and join him, and he offered to buy him a one-way train ticket. The job would allow Louie to resume the apprenticeship that had been interrupted when Oliver left New Orleans in 1918. But did he really need any more apprenticing? His cornet playing was now impressing a whole lot of people. Paul Maris, a white musician originally from New Orleans who liked to hang around the bandstand at Lincoln Gardens, teased King Oliver about the kid he'd heard back home. "If he ever gets here, you're dead." Oliver's own band members asked him, perhaps innocently or perhaps not, "Is Louis Armstrong being brought in to play first cornet or second?" Oliver could only stammer in response, "It's my band. What am I going to do? Play second?" The success of Oliver's band was in both music and comedy. And at the center of their act for years prior to their time in Chicago was a floor show skit they always performed on their tours. It was set against a backdrop painting of a plantation with log cabin, the master's big house, and many little darky huts scattered amidst blossoming cotton fields. The musicians dressed as slaves and wandered over to the cabin of Old Black Joe. With a full moon rising slowly in the background, they began to play My Old Kentucky Home. The infectious ragtime rhythms loosing up Old Joe's arthritic knees and causing him to dance in a madcap way that held tremendous comic appeal. Entertainment like this was a part of how the nation was trying to reconcile itself to the Civil War, to heal wounds that had been festering for 5 decades. This was accomplished by romanticizing slavery. The band was doing what minstrelsy has always done, helping the white nation define blacks as inferior. "The mask of minstrelsy is torn off," said one reviewer, meaning that in contrast to white imitators wearing blackface, this band was the real thing. More knowingly came this comment from an African American weekly. "It's an act that shows very clearly what the white theater patrons like the colored performers to do." Jazz was surrounded by plantation imagery as soon as it left New Orleans, and the theme would keep crowding in on Armstrong for the rest of his life.
"All the pale moon shining, the fields below."
In the early 1930s, he picked up When It's Sleepy Time Down South as his signature song, with its imagery of darkies crooning under a pale moon. In 1942, he performed the song for a movie short, seated on a cotton bale in a plaid shirt and farmer's hat, fixing this image in the minds of a new generation of white Americans. In the early 1950s, as the fervor for civil rights began to take hold, African Americans burned his recording of the song, forcing him to reissue it with revised lyrics. But back in Chicago in 1922, King Oliver and his bandmates are not trying to convey a sense of retrogressive plantation authenticity. They aren't wearing farm costumes. They are tricked out in tuxedos. Louis Armstrong has only been in the city for a few hours, but he's already getting a sense of what the long trip from New Orleans to Chicago might mean. The floor show here is for an overwhelmingly black audience. The emphasis is on the band characters. Drummer Baby Dodds does his shimmy beat, a bit of musical comedy that has him shaking his stomach muscles in time with his drumming. Armstrong stares at this vision in fascination. He would say later that watching Baby shimmy was, in my estimation, worth the whole price of admission. Then comes the dance segment of the evening, difficult when the hall is crowded, but everyone has a good time. The music was so wonderful, remembered Baby Dodds with pride, that they had to do something, even if there was only room to bounce around. Armstrong described the dance floor as a picture of rhythm such as I had never seen. There was a faster tempo, faster than the typical pace of New Orleans. The fastest numbers played by old New Orleans bands were slower than the Chicago tempo. There were several reasons for this regional difference. For one thing, it's easier to generate excitement and disguise musical inadequacies with a fast tempo, just as low-quality beer is more drinkable when it's ice cold. The tempo also had to do with a different conception of what dancing is about. The famous Broadway ballroom dancing team of Irene and Vernon Castle were promoting dance as exercise, which helped legitimize the peppy ragtime dances of the time. We were making ourselves lithe and slim and healthy, said Irene. It's hard to know if this idea infused the patrons of Lincoln Gardens in Chicago, but one thing is certain. The idea of dance as a health-inducing exercise had never occurred to the patrons of Funky Butt Hall in New Orleans. There's also an element of prudery in the North. Unfamiliar to Louis and his fellows, the White Reform Group, the Juvenile Protective Association, hired chaperones to go out on the town and inspect dance halls. When a chaperone sees a couple standing on one spot for too long, he barks out, "Get off that dime, man! Let's move it around!" The threat, if they don't, is forced closure of the hall. When King Oliver eventually decides it's time to finish his set, he signals the final chorus with a single stomp on the floor. He pulls the cornet away from his lips, glances down at an ecstatic young admirer and winks, "We're hotter than a 45. One writer in the 1920s described African-American migration as movement from a medieval world to a modern one. But Armstrong would not think of that day's train ride in those terms. One comfort of his relocation is that he landed within a strong network of New Orleanian colleagues in Chicago. What attracted him was not the thrill of the new, but the familiar ways of home, musical and otherwise. Nevertheless, August 8, 1922, was an important turning point date in jazz history. Louis Armstrong, his mentor, and his friends from the South were going to make something new in the North, spurred on by their fellow immigrants who came looking for a better life and wanted music to go along with it. Chicago would become his home, and from there, he would make his mark.
Colin McFarlane was reading from Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism by Thomas Brothers. The book is abridged by Eileen Horn, produced by Clive Brill, and is a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. Now on Radio 4, time for the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on today, Tuesday, the 8th of April. There are warnings of gales in German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover and Wight. The general synopsis at 1800, low 40s 997, expected Norwegian...